Thank you for standing by. Today's conference is now being recorded. If anyone has any objections, they may disconnect at this time. Now I'll turn the meeting over to Ms. Trina Ray.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone, to today's Charm Telecon. We've had some very exciting flybys of one of the smaller, or one of the moons of Saturn, Enceladus, recently. two in particular targeted flybys, one in February and July. And joining us today to talk about some of the recent results is Dr. Larry Esposito. He's the principal investigator of the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph. And unless I'm mistaken, Larry, you're joining us from London, or did you decide to stay home?
I came home from Cambridge.
Ah.
I got home last night, so I'm joining you from Boulder, Colorado.
Okay. Well, take it away, Larry, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Trina. So everyone who's online, hopefully you're looking at my first slide, which says Enceladus Eruptions, and identifies me as the principal investigator of UV imaging spectrograph. If anybody's having a technical challenge at this point, inform me of that. Otherwise, I'm going to just proceed here with the slides that I have and my presentation, which, as Trina said, is some very recent and very exciting results about the tiny moon Enceladus, a moon of Saturn. We go to the next slide. I want to remind you of some of the mysteries that we now are aware of about this moon Enceladus. It turns out that it is the shiniest object in the entire solar system. It's very reflective. It's a bright object, maybe as bright in some spots as newly fallen snow. And even before spacecraft had visited Enceladus, one of the mysteries was how it could be so bright and shiny, because space is a place where there are things that are always degrading and darkening. The radiation in the Saturn system, sunlight, meteoritic bombardment, all would turn clean surfaces very quickly into dark and dirty surfaces of satellites and rings. And one of the things that's a little bit of a mystery, particularly about Enceladus, is why it is so bright. But I think we may have a partial answer to that based on the new Cassini results. That is that it's bright and shiny because the material on the surface has not been exposed very long to these darkening agents. The second of the mysteries has to do with the geology of Enceladus. And we've got our first clues about this when we flew by with Voyager more than 20 years ago. But now the close-ups of Enceladus show very broad plains that have no craters on them. The process of bodies in the solar system striking the surfaces of moons and planets has been going on for billions of years. And we see the results on our own moon, where the ancient surfaces of the moons, particularly the highlands, are completely covered by craters, one crater on top of another. And the lava plains, the mare, the seas of the moon, are cratered but much less, showing that they are younger than the ancient highlands. In the same way, when we see these broad plains that have no craters on Enceladus, we know that they're very young. Another mystery has to do with the location of Enceladus at the center of Saturn's E ring. And this is a very thin ring. It's not obvious yet that we have clear pictures of it from Cassini, but it's been observed from the ground, and it's a ring that's unlike the other rings of Saturn, which are broad and bright. It seems to be made up of very small particles spread both in distance from Saturn and above and below Saturn's equatorial plane. But amazingly enough, the moon Enceladus, a tiny moon, is at the center of Saturn's E-ring, and we've been searching for a connection, maybe a connection that's now becoming apparent to us. The fourth mystery, which I want to mention, is that just a year ago, as the Cassini spacecraft approached Saturn, the spacecraft made systematic scans, mosaics, pictures of the entire Saturn system. And these scans were analyzed by the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph team, and we were able to identify a cloud of oxygen atoms around Saturn. And we were able to see these because of the characteristic light that's shining from these oxygen atoms. It's like a fingerprint. The spectrum shows a strong emission at a wavelength of 1304 angstroms, which can only be produced by oxygen atoms. And the number of atoms we discovered was many more than people had expected. And surprisingly enough, the distribution, the number of oxygen atoms, also showed a peak near Enceladus orbit. I'm moving to my next slide, which is about the first clues that Cassini had of something more exciting happening on Enceladus. On the 17th of February in 2005, we had a close flyby of Enceladus, and Cassini's magnetometer detected a bending of the magnetic field around Enceladus. Now, this may seem a minor or maybe even a negligible discovery, but the magnetic field, like an electromagnet or the Earth's magnetic field, is excluded by conductors. It looked as though there was a conducting layer surrounding the moon Enceladus, which the investigators hypothesized may have been the result of ions formed by sunlight falling on the atmosphere of Enceladus, if it had one. So the idea was there might be an atmosphere around Enceladus, and light from the sun would be removing electrons from some of the atoms in the atmosphere, making them conductors, and those conductors would exclude the magnetic field from the region around Enceladus. Now, this was a very exciting indirect indication that Enceladus might have an atmosphere, and the project decided to reinvest some of its resources and to replan the later flyby of Enceladus, which was scheduled for July of this year, to fly very, very close to the moon, to fly within 175 kilometers of the surface of Enceladus. Now, Enceladus is not a big object. It's only 500 kilometers across. That's 300 miles. If I got into my car here in Boulder, I would be in Nebraska in a few hours, at about the distance, the size of the whole moon Enceladus. So it's a tiny moon. It's not expected to have an atmosphere. It's not expected to have any sort of geologic activity. In fact, it's expected to be just sort of an ice cube that's been sitting around Saturn for 4.5 billion years and gradually ground its surface, ground down and marked up and dirtied by meteorite impacts and covered with craters. And we knew from the first that it wasn't what we expected, but we didn't know exactly why that was the case. I'm moving to my next slide, which is a demonstration of the effect that was seen by the magnetometer. And what you're seeing here, these yellow arrows and lines and all that yellow stuff, is truly invisible. It's a representation of the Van Allen belts of Saturn, which are trapped by the magnetic field. And as the moon Enceladus, which you can see on the right, moves around Saturn, it moves through that magnetic environment mostly without any trouble, except if there might be some cloud near Enceladus. And here the artist has drawn a neutral cloud, and you can see on the diagram how the lines of magnetic force have changed their location. The lines of magnetic force are excluded by the neutrals in the cloud, which is shown here near the southern pole of Enceladus. That's a point we didn't know yet. So that already in February, we had some indications that Enceladus was unusual, and the project used some of its capability to readjust the mission to aim for a close flyby of the moon in the month of July. So Cassini was redirected to fly within 179 kilometers of Enceladus on the 14th of July, 2005. We see the pictures here, the ISS color mosaic of Enceladus on Rev 11, which was that 11th orbit the spacecraft had made around Saturn. And in the month of July, at the closest approach to Enceladus, it took these pictures. And now if you look at this picture, you'll see some very interesting things. In the upper right-hand part of the moon, you see a number of craters, bowl-shaped depressions, which have been caused by meteors that have hit the satellite. On the other hand, on the lower right, there are no craters to be seen at all. Instead, there are these stripes that go upper left to lower right, and the imaging team members have called these tiger stripes. They resemble the stripes on a tiger, and the parallel stripes were unexpected from earlier images and show two things. They show that there's been a recent, we don't know exactly how recent, maybe millions or even billions of years, but a recent event which has covered up the southern region of Enceladus, and that has stretched the surface so that it's broken to form these fissures, which we see as tiger stripes. And the color of those features is a bluish haze, a bluish hue, and that bluish hue says that the ice that's in the craters, I'm sorry, that in the fissures, in those tiger stripes, that the ice there is relatively young and maybe fresh, at least geologically fresh. So, with this information, there's geologic evidence of recent resurfacing and splitting of the icy surface of Enceladus. And beyond that, those picture information, we go to the next slide, we can look at even closer views, and you can see on these views that there are cracks, fissures that extend in one direction, and then others that extend in another direction, and in some places in the picture they cross each other. This is a typical indication of multiple stages of geology active on the surface. You can see that some of the fissures cut across humps on the surface, and that this means that things occurred one after another. There were spreading or extension along one direction and later extension along another direction. The more recent geologic events cut the older geologic structure. You can see a boundary around the bottom third of the image where some of the older features that are vertical in the picture look like parallel tracks end at a big boundary. And so a geologic interpretation of that is that the earlier in the history of Enceladus, those vertical cracks extended all the way to the top of the picture, but later something smoothed them out, potentially a flow of lava across the surface of Enceladus to erase those pre-existing cracks and leave a new clean area, which now we see has also been cracked itself, so that there are stages of fissures and overflow and more fissures being formed. The geology is very interesting. Let's go to the next slide, which shows a red line around the south pole of Enceladus. This is a picture that shows a whole region of Enceladus that looks relatively young. Evidence of these young features has a different, slightly different color than the rest of the moon, a little more of a bluish hue, and evidence for boundaries that are indicated by those red lines. And so a simple geologic interpretation would be that there have been volcanic flows somewhere near the south pole that had erased the craters that are only visible outside now of that red line. Let's go to the next slide. Another close-up of those tiger stripes, and you can see the tortuous geology on the surface of Enceladus here, where the fact that we see ridges and troughs cutting other ridges and troughs seems to indicate not just a single episode, but multiple episodes of twisting and turning of the crust of Enceladus. Now on the Earth, we see these same sort of features in the Basin and Range in the U.S. Southwest. We see these sorts of features near volcanic rifts like in East Africa, and they're all evidence of internal activity on the Earth. On the Earth, we have radioactivity heating the interior of the Earth, which melts the rock. Warm rock rises, and these flows of rock capture some of the solid rock on the surface and drag it along, cracking it and breaking it, pushing it up against other pieces of Earth rock. So you can imagine a similar thing happening on Enceladus, where the interior is warmed by some process. Fluid motions move the interior, which take along the icy surface, crack it, and break it. And potentially, where those cracks occur, there could be volcanic eruptions or events, as we see in the Earth, at Yellowstone, or, for example, in Hawaii, at Mauna Kea. So that potentially, Enceladus is evidencing the same sort of active geology and volcanic or geothermal activity that we might see on the Earth. Now, Enceladus is made of ice, and at the temperature of Enceladus, about 80 degrees above absolute zero, ice is a really good rock, and for the most part, it's completely solid and competent, every bit as good as granite or marble. Except, like on the Earth, you can melt that rock, and then you would have some sort of volcanic activity, and we think that ice is acting like rock on Earth, melted underneath the surface and emerging like molten rock or like water through vents and geysers in Yellowstone Park. We go to the next slide. This shows a close-up of one part of that Cassini picture, and here you can see small boulders in the insert, small boulders that are lying on the surface. Really looks like something has happened there. Those boulders are a remarkably youthful feature and show that there's some sort of activity or some sort of phenomenon going on the surface of Enceladus that is very recent. It might, from these pictures, even be something that's happening at the same time, at the time that we are looking now, this present time. Next slide shows just a close-up here, and you see some of the structures where the surface of Enceladus has been stretched and broken, and small icy boulders lie on that surface, and pits as well. Let's go to the next slide, which is a continuation of our story. So just to repeat here, from Voyager, we knew that Enceladus was very bright and had regions that were youthful that lacked craters. From the first Enceladus flyby in February, we knew that it might have an atmosphere that was disrupting the magnetic field near Enceladus. The close-up pictures from July showed very youthful geologic features and geology that was consistent with a much more active surface than we might have imagined. At the same time, on that July 14th flyby, the composite infrared spectrometer called SEERS made measurements of radiation from Enceladus that allowed us to measure the temperature on July 14th. And now we're looking at that with two color photographs, one on the left called predicted temperatures and one on the right called observed temperatures. So the predicted temperature for Enceladus would be a very smooth temperature, with the hottest, the reddest, shown in these colors up near the point where the sun is directly overhead. And the hottest temperatures we might expect on Enceladus are about 80 degrees above absolute zero, about the same temperature as liquid nitrogen. Instead, two things are different in the observed temperature. First, the peak is at the South Pole, and that's where the sun isn't really shining. That you look at the predicted temperatures, and they go black there because there's no sunlight falling there. It should be very cold. And the second thing is the actual observed temperatures are up to 90 degrees Kelvin, some 10 or more degrees above the warmest temperatures predicted anywhere on Enceladus. Let's go to the next slide. The composite infrared spectrometer, SEERS, has capability to make some very primitive pictures, and overlaid on this imaging picture of one of the tiger stripes is their single line of detectors, a one-dimensional picture, and these red and yellow squares show the places where the spectrometer was able to measure the temperature. And you can see that the temperature they measure peaks at about 90 degrees right on top of one of these fissures. So the fissure is exceptionally warm. Enceladus is exceptionally warm. It's exceptionally warm in the South Polar region. And when we look at that region in the infrared, we're able to measure temperatures that are well in excess of what sun could cause, and particularly the highest temperatures are right where those fissures are. Now, there's another way to measure temperature that the instrument also used, where they can extend their capability to look for regions that are smaller than they can see that might have a higher temperature. And looking at those so-called color temperatures, they're able to measure a temperature of 140 degrees Kelvin at these locations along the tiger stripe fissure in the picture here. So that still may be an underestimate of the real physical temperature if we were to land an astronaut there who had a thermometer to stick in the surface. But those temperatures are well in excess of anything that could be caused by sunlight or any sort of greenhouse effect on Enceladus. Let's go to the next slide. So in addition to the infrared spectrometer, the UV spectrometer watched a star as it set behind the moon Enceladus. And this is sort of an indirect but a very sensitive way to detect an atmosphere, because if there's any atmosphere around the moon, that will remove starlight, which is immediately detectable to our experiment. In fact, we measure the light from the star 500 times a second, looking for light removal. And this next slide you see here, called UVIS stellar occultation, shows the path of the star behind Enceladus and shows clearly the star dimming as it approached the surface of Enceladus. So this is an obvious indication that there's an atmosphere around Enceladus. The most interesting thing about this, let's go to the next slide, you can see the exact location of our star occultation. If you had been sitting on the spacecraft, where the star would have appeared relative to the bright edge of Enceladus. Next slide, both going in and going out. And if we go to the slide that now says A and B, we can compare the star that was observed by us in July with the star in February. And you can see in the star setting in July, there's a definite loss of light from the star, a definite dimming, which was not seen at all in February. In February, there's a sharp cutoff in the light consistent with the hard limb of Enceladus, consistent with the star just blinking off as it went behind the solid surface of Enceladus, whereas in July, there's evidence of a slower decline, which shows us that Enceladus had an atmosphere at that time. Now, the comparison of the star set and star rise in July showed that there was no similar dimming as the star emerged from the dark side of Enceladus. And so what we're seeing is not something that varies in time, but probably an atmosphere that is variable in space, is not uniform around the whole moon Enceladus. So the way to explain these star occultations is there's just a patch of atmosphere very much near the South Pole. And you can see the artist has indicated that here in that fuzzy area below the moon Enceladus. And in July, the star passed behind that cloud, and we were able to see that pinkish decrease in sunlight. In February, we had not crossed behind that particular hypothesized cloud, so we didn't see the diminution of starlight. So the results from the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph, next slide, are that there's a clear indication of the signal loss, attenuation of the signal, dimming of the star during the approach to Enceladus, the ingress. And during the outgress, there's not any indication of the atmosphere. The change in star light is just a result of the instrument warming up again after being hidden from the star by the moon. And the altitude of the atmosphere that we see is around 155 kilometers. Next slide, we see a slightly different part of the results from the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph. In addition to the photometer, which measures the brightness of the star, we're also able to measure the spectrum of the star, that is, break the light from the star down into its component colors. And on the bottom of this are numbers 1200, 1400, 1600, 1800. Those are the wavelengths of light in angstroms. And all this light, 1200 to 1800 angstroms, in fact, all the light the UV spectrometer analyzes is invisible to the human eye. So this light would not have been visible to a human on the spacecraft, and it was also not visible to the cameras on the spacecraft. But by looking at the spectroscopy, we're able to match the observations with the absorption spectrum of water vapor. And what you can see here is that the red line on the graph is a model of water vapor in the atmosphere of Enceladus, and we can absolutely identify its signature here in the spectrum of the star. So the light from the star that's missing is exactly at the places where water absorbs. So not only are we able to identify water, but we're able to determine how much water there is in that atmosphere. And it's a small amount. It would be a very, very thin atmosphere. It would be an atmosphere that we would really call a vacuum. We wouldn't be able to breathe in there. We don't want to breathe water anyway. We don't see any oxygen, nor do we see hydrogen in there, which looks like just a vent, a jet of water coming out of one of those fissures that happened to be between us and the star that we were watching. We go to the next slide. We have on this slide the location of spectral features of carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide could also be identified by removing light from the star at its particular absorbing wavelength. But we don't see any here. That allows us to set an upper limit of only a few percent of the water is being accompanied by carbon monoxide. And this is important because I'm going to talk in just a second about the results of another Cassini experiment, the ion and neutral mass spectrometer, which was able to detect not only the water we saw, but other constituents in the atmosphere. But its detection is of a different sort. All it's able to detect is the mass of the molecule that is in the atmosphere. So they detected mass 18, which is H2O, and they detected mass 28, which is a little bit of a mystery. Not that there aren't molecules with an atomic mass of 28, molecular mass of 28 atomic mass units, but there are two, at least, that were of interest. One could be two molecules of nitrogen at 14 each. Another could be a molecule of carbon monoxide at 12 for carbon plus 16 for oxygen. What our results show is it's very unlikely that they saw carbon monoxide. So that the likely measurement of the neutral mass spectrometer can now be interpreted in light of the ultraviolet results to show some significant fraction of nitrogen molecules that are also accompanying the water escaping from the surface of Enceladus. Let's go to the next slide. And this is from a graph from the ion neutral mass spectrometer, and it shows the density of water molecules with altitude. There's also a purple line there, which is a computer model, and all that a person could say is that computer model is not very successful explaining the blue and red measurements. So what that means is our models of what's happening on the surface of Enceladus are still incomplete, but this does show the definite phenomenon that water is much more abundant near the surface of Enceladus, and secondly, that at two different places where the spacecraft approached Enceladus and just a little later where it exited, there are big variations in the amount of water. The blue and the red dots are not on top of each other. In fact, are different by some large factors, maybe a factor of 10 from place to place. And this says, once again, like the UVIS results from the ultraviolet star occultation, that the atmosphere of Enceladus is really not uniform. It's really varying from place to place strongly by maybe a factor of 10. And this says maybe atmosphere is the wrong thing to talk about, and many of us have been talking about these eruptions on Enceladus as being like a vent eruption, like a geyser, like a jet from a comet. And those are in one place and not on another. So if you happen to fly through one, you see a big measurement of water vapor, or if a star happens to pass behind one of those jets. But if it doesn't go near the vent, then you see something really different, and that explains why three of the four star occultation cuts, two approach and two going away from Enceladus in February and July, of all those four, only one actually shows the presence of water vapor. Let's go to the next slide, which is a slide showing the mass spectrum below 500 kilometers altitude. And what you want to see here is you can look and see there's a big mass, a big peak at mass 18, which is water. And there's another big peak at mass 28, which is most likely nitrogen molecules. Let's go to the next slide. So I've mentioned so far the magnetometer results, the camera results, the infrared spectrometer results, the ultraviolet spectrometer results, the ion and neutral mass spectrometer results, all showing an indication of a very confined, a very sharp presence of water near Enceladus. In fact, because of the lack of hydrogen and oxygen, probably water that was just freshly released from the surface and hasn't had a time to be broken down by sunlight into its atomic constituents. And in addition to that, there were also direct measurements made by the Cosmic Dust Analyzer, a small instrument on the spacecraft that measures dust particles, small grains, near and distant from Saturn. And what they see in this slide that I'm showing, their high rate detector detects a abundance of small grains near Enceladus. Now that's very exciting, but the more exciting thing is that those grains are not symmetric about the moon. In fact, they seem to be coming from someplace very near the South Pole, which is exactly where the spectrometers are seeing evidence of current activity, current eruptions on Enceladus. So the cosmic dust measurements, the direct measurements of dust near Enceladus, also show some evidence for eruption. And the idea would be, like on a comet, as the gases are shot out from the comet vent or a jet on the comet, they also carry small grains of ice. And as the jet moves away from the comet, the gas and the ice separate a little bit. And it's seen here that the maximum of dust is some 25 seconds later than the maximum of water that was seen by the neutral mass spectrometer, both on the Cassini spacecraft as it flew by Enceladus. So near closest approach, but not exactly at closest approach, the amount of water vapor there at the spacecraft and the amount of dust peaked, but at different points. So this is saying to us that we have a very complicated and unsymmetric source of water and dust near the South Pole of Enceladus, most likely associated with geologic activity where water vapor and associated molecules of nitrogen and grains of ice are being shot out of a fissure, what the camera team called the Tiger Stripes. Next slide. So this slide shows how we can distinguish where those dust particles are coming from, and the blue curves are offset from the curves that show the very symmetric prediction if even the southern hemisphere was the whole source. So we're seeing a source of dust that's shown in this model to be much, much smaller, than much more localized than the whole southern hemisphere, and maybe only a few percent of the surface, and maybe just one or more of those Tiger Stripes is actually now emitting gas and dust. We flew by Halley's Comet. We saw jets of dust turn on and turn off, and so that may be the same sort of thing that's happening on Enceladus. Next slide. So looking again at the picture of Enceladus, it's quite possible that each of these Tiger Stripes, or some fraction of them, is a eruptive event, something like a geyser occurring on Enceladus. It may not occur all the time, and that the activity, the geologic activity associated with those eruptions is what's made the surface of Enceladus appear so young near the South Pole. We go to the next slide. You may ask, how could we possibly explain this? And one possible explanation is there's some sort of heat in the interior of Enceladus. The picture we're looking at now is an idealized model of a block of the surface of Enceladus with that blue feature along the top. That prismatic feature is meant to represent one of the Tiger Stripes. And so we see there's a Tiger Stripe, which is a hole in the surface of Enceladus. And underneath that hole, there's some source of heat. We don't know if it's from radioactive materials or if it's from tides. The stretching of Io by Jupiter is what's the source of volcanic activity on the moon Io. And in a similar way, there may be some sort of stretching and pulling of the interior of the moon Enceladus to produce heat. But there's a challenge with that. Enceladus is very small. There doesn't seem to be any particularly strong tides raised on it. And in fact, if Enceladus, it does have a source of heat, why is it that the other satellites, the other small satellites near Saturn, and even bigger satellites like Tethys and Rhea, do not have a similar sort of heat and a similar sort of eruption like we see around Enceladus? That's an unanswered question. But there are two things I want to draw your attention to on this figure. One is the idea of a slurry. There's essentially the possibility of an antifreeze in the water that's underneath the surface of Enceladus. And a good antifreeze would be ammonia. So if we mix ammonia with water, we can make a sort of slurry that will not freeze until about 100 degrees centigrade below zero, or a temperature of 170 degrees Kelvin. And so this gives us the possibility, this antifreeze gives us the possibility of using less heat and still making some liquid water underneath the surface, which then would be under pressure and could potentially escape through a vent in the surface. And at the top, you can see little arrows showing the evaporating H2O molecules. And those are the ones that were seen by the UVIS and by the ultraviolet spectrometer and by the neutral mass spectrometer. So what's really been seen is what's up at the top, those little arrowheads. Everything below that is an inference of a possibility, and maybe not one that's generally agreed to, but one possibility of explaining the source of this eruptive activity on Enceladus. Next slide. So here's a summary slide. If you click on that, you can see that the imaging system has shown a young, warm south pole. Click again, you can see there's a tenuous polar atmosphere, which is shown by the ultraviolet spectrometer, neutral mass spectrometer, and the magnetometer field draping. And there's a non-uniform distribution of particles, grains of ice, that have been seen by the CDA. So the whole story together is a story for eruptions, venting of gases, particularly water vapor, sort of water-style active geology that parallels the rocks melting and releasing water here in geothermal systems and on the Earth. And a puzzle that this leaves us is how such a tiny little satellite, only 300 miles across, could continue to be warm and active and giving us a spectacular showing after 4.5 million years. The next slide just summarizes the results from my experiment. That the occultation of the star Bellatrix, Gamma Orionis, on July 14th, determined the composition of the Enceladus atmosphere. It's water vapor with limited amounts of carbon monoxide, perhaps some nitrogen in there. It also said that Enceladus atmosphere is very localized, and the picture we have in mind are jets of gases and entrained grains of ice shooting off out of the fissures in the surface. And we've done preliminary calculations of the amount of water vapor escaping, and that amount is sufficient to supply the atomic oxygen in the Saturn system that was detected by the UVIS, and also to resupply Saturn's E-ring, so that potentially these eruptions of water and ice from the surface of Enceladus are making Saturn's E-ring and also making the cloud of oxygen that was discovered just last year by Cassini. So that concludes my presentation. In summary, we're potentially solving some of the mysteries of Enceladus. If it has geologic activity, including hydrothermal vents and geysers, then that would explain why the surface is young and so bright and shiny, and the material that's escaping from Enceladus in these vents is enough to make the cloud of oxygen that was discovered by Cassini, and also to make the particles that form the very, very tenuous E-ring around Saturn. This conclusion of my presentation, and I'm open to your responses, and I thank you for your attention. Goodbye. Hello, I didn't really sign off, but I am able to take questions now if
Larry?
People have them. Yes, go ahead.
Larry, can you hear me? This is Ron Hobbs. I'm a solar system ambassador, and you know, if any data came from this flyby that gives any evidence Enceladus being differentiated, one would imagine if it was warm and if there's something that's that all the heavy stuff would have gone down to the center. Is there any evidence of that?
Not that I've heard yet.
Thank you.
Larry, this is Rachel Manser. I'm a solar system educator. My question to you is, based upon all this evidence that was recently found from the flyby, are there other plans to do more flybys of the moon?
Well, that's a very good question, and you know, the reason we did this flyby was because of the discoveries we made in February. And I think it's a very natural thing for the Project Science Group to consider changes to our current plan to have other close flybys of Enceladus, and that's really what we need to sort out this very complicated structure here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Larry, this is Steve Lee down at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science.
I know you, Steve. Go ahead.
I'm still a little confused about the energy source to actually, you know, produce the melting on Enceladus. I I thought there wasn't a strong orbital or tidal resonance for Enceladus right now, and I guess
that is true.
Is there evidence that you know the orbital changes would support a stronger resonance in the past? Or how does that work?
So your question is a good one in that the tides, there's no theory that would give the tidal heating that's sufficient to melt the interior of Enceladus. There's no reason to expect at this present moment that tidal heating is sufficient. And we're guessing that if tides were raised inside Enceladus, they could melt it. It's possible that there was a situation in the past where there could have been more tidal excitement. I don't know any good evidence for that. There's also the possibility that Enceladus might have been spinning much more rapidly early on, and when it was slowed down that to its current rate, where one side always faces Saturn, just like one side of the Earth's moon always faces the Earth, when it was slowed down to that synchronous rotation, that energy was released, which is now stored and could do the work to melt that water. But there is no good explanation right now of how the interior could melt to create these eruptions that we're seeing. Nonetheless, we see water vapor, which would not melt at the temperature of Enceladus. And SEERS, the infrared spectrometer, sees a surface that is much warmer than can be explained by sunlight.
So I guess the theorists need to catch up with the observations now.
That's a particular advantage of space missions, that we provide material which really needs to be explained. And just as you said, the explanation is not clear at this moment.
Okay, thanks.
Larry?
Yes.
This is Alan Davenport up at the University of Maine. I'm in the planetarium here.
Yes.
I want to thank you first for taking the time to be with us. This is fantastic. I was wondering if any information or data from your study so far of Enceladus would allow you to say that it did or did not possibly form as a KBO much further out. Is there any signature or compositional information that enables you to establish its origin?
It doesn't appear distinctly different from other Saturn satellites, except it's brighter and has more water visible on the surface. So that's certainly consistent with it being a captured Kuiper Belt object. But it's hard to imagine an object wandering in from the Kuiper Belt ending up so close to Saturn, within 4 radii of Saturn, and in such a regular orbit, equatorial, uninclined, low eccentricity orbit. So it certainly has characteristics which remind one of a Kuiper Belt object, and it's not impossible. It's just a very improbable event that an object could have come from so far away and end up right in the middle of the Saturn-Moon family.
I understand. Thank you very much.
Larry, this is Rachel again. Has this all hit the, just out of curiosity, has this all hit the newspapers and the science magazines yet?
No.
No? Okay.
Let me say that a little more clearly, because you know on this telecon, we can't talk about things that haven't been released yet.
Okay.
But this morning in London, there was a press release, a press conference associated with the PSG. So just this morning, some of the more recent information that is about the composition of the material coming off of Enceladus, and about the fact that there's sufficient material to actually explain the existence of the E-ring and to produce all the oxygen we see in the Cassini-discovered ring. These have just been released today, so you probably won't see them in the paper until tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Doctor, this is Mike Lucas, Solar System Ambassador.
Yes.
Reference the cloud activity around the southern pole and sun to break down that issue. Are you suggesting that moon is the end of the E-ring?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question. Could you repeat a little closer to the mic?
Yeah, is there a suggestion that Enceladus is evaporating into the E-ring?
Right. Not all of Enceladus, but the amount of material that's needed to produce the E-ring against the losses due to grinding by meteorites and erosion by the plasma in the Van Allen belts of Saturn, the amount that's needed is about a kilogram per second. And the amount of dust that's coming out of the event on Enceladus, if it represents just a few percent of the water that we see, and it's also water, it would just be water ice. So just a few percent of the water we see is 10 kilograms per second. So the amount of material that's coming out of Enceladus is enough to create and replenish the E-ring. And that might seem, you know, to replenish a ring might seem like a lot, but remember, this is the E-ring, which has just barely been seen by Cassini. So we're not talking about making the main rings of Saturn by grinding up or evaporating Enceladus, but we're talking about making one of the very tenuous rings that's centered on Enceladus from dust grains of ice that are blown out of these vents.
This is a very bizarre place.
Yes. Well, nobody could really have predicted this, and that's as I was explaining to Dr. Lee. This is one of the reasons that you have to go there. That being there is much better than any sort of theorizing or modeling we can do before the event.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you.
Are there other questions?
Larry, this is Steve Lee again. You talked about the possibility of future alterations to the mission. How likely do you think that's going to be to get some more really close flybys where you could examine these possible eruptions?
So I can't say because all the people who are making that decision are meeting Thursday in London. But in teleconferences that we've had in the past few weeks, there's been significant support for changing the mission. There's likely to be some valid resistance to that because it may cost more fuel and it may cause people to rework some of the plans that they have already. So I think that is going to come out of a decision that's still going to, a meeting that's still going to be held in a few days. And I believe even if we don't reprogram the mission to look at Enceladus more closely during the nominal mission during the next few years, it's possible that the mission would be extended. And in such a mission, that would be one of the major objectives, that the actual orbit of the spacecraft would be designed so it would encounter Enceladus multiple times. We still have that all open in the extended mission, and at the moment we have fuel and electrical power and all the other resources so that the mission could be extended 2 or 4 years.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
So if there are no more questions, I thank you again for your attention, and good luck to any dissemination of these very interesting Cassini-Huygens results, and thank you again, and goodbye.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.